This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibb. You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Now, here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, Night People. This is Gibb. Standing by in Washington, D.C. is Mr. William F. Haddad. Mr. Haddad recently resigned as Assistant Director and Inspector General of the War on Poverty. He also was a founder and associate director of the Peace Corps, and he served as a reporter on the New York Post and the Herald Tribune, along with being a special assistant to both Robert F. Kennedy and Senator Kefauver. During World War II, Bill was the youngest officer in the Merchant Marines, becoming an officer at the tender age of 16. He's a graduate of Columbia University and Georgetown University. Now, if you'd like to ask Bill a question on tonight's topic, the savage politics of poverty, or make a comment about the poverty program, give us a call here at Night Call. Now, you may dial us direct. Our national number is area code 313-846-6601. Now, remember, you may call from anywhere collect. You may reverse the charges. And when you call us, please make that call station to station. Our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. Our operators are on duty, our lines are open, and we invite you to share with us your opinion here on Night Call. Our guest, Mr. William F. Haddad, he is the ex-Inspector General of the War on Poverty, and we'll be talking about the savage politics of poverty on Night Call. Mr. Haddad, what is happening with the War on Poverty?
Well, one of the things that's happening, it's spreading around the country, and wherever it goes, it raises problems because it's touching on situations that have been dormant for years. In trying to break the cycle of poverty, which is to ensure that the children of poverty don't become the parents of poverty, and that's the pattern of poverty in this country, they are challenging some of the basic institutions and many of the politicians who've been trying to do the job for many years. And in doing this, you run across many, many problems, as you can read in the newspapers.
Bill, is this a good war?
Yes, it is. It's not only a good war, it's a just war, it's a needed war, it's an inevitable war. It's to do what our society has failed to do since the institution of this country. It's to eliminate poverty from our society. We're rich enough, we're smart enough, we're able enough to do the job. The way is there if we have the will. And the will means we've got to go through these problems and we've got to arrive at some of the solutions. And the horrible pattern of all of this is that, as I mentioned a moment ago, that the children of poverty grow up to be the parents of poverty, and they breed children of poverty. And it's this vicious, self-perpetuating cycle that President Johnson's war on poverty is out to change. And I think perhaps, for people who don't understand it, the most important thing that it's doing is in the community action area. This is where the federal government puts money into a city for programs that the city or the county or the state decide for themselves are the most important. But there are certain necessary federal regulations that go along with it. And I think the most important of these is just one phrase in the congressional legislation. And that phrase says that this war on poverty is to be run by the people in poverty, that they're to have the maximum feasible participation at all levels. And that means the decision level at the top and the working level at the bottom.
Now, you're saying then that people that are poor are going to have a voice in the poverty program.
Yes, and not the traditional voice that they've had before, which is a condescending way. This is a real voice, a real chance to participate. The poor might not be as articulate as other people, but they know what their problems are. And one of the secrets of this war is to bring the established institutions, the school system, the social welfare groups, the voluntary agencies, bring them together with the poor themselves. What's developed over the years, and there's no right or wrong to this, but what's developed over the years is that the poor have become alienated from the traditional servants of the poor. Almost all the studies that the War on Poverty undertook all over the country, in Appalachia, in the Southwest, in the Northwest, in the Midwest, in the urban areas, it was almost universal that those who helped the poor failed to communicate with the poor. It's almost like in the African countries in colonialism, and that was the analogy we heard many, many times. This paternalistic attitude of we will help the poor instead of letting the poor help themselves. And the war on poverty is designed to help have the poor help themselves. And we just didn't say it as sort of a cliche. What we did in designing the legislation was to make very rigid structural methods for this to work. Let me give you an example. When the federal government in previous days appropriated money for a program, they gave it to a city or to a county. Take a city, for example. The money would go to the mayor, and the mayor would spend it through the political apparatus. And in many of the big cities in the United States, that meant through the patronage and contract system.
He'd come off looking like a good guy then.
That's right. The money would go to him, and he'd spend it as he wanted to spend it. He was the chief elected officer. He had a position of power. He would bear the responsibility of whether it succeeded or failed. But we undertook a new course. We said an independent corporation must be formed. And on that independent corporation, in addition to the mayor and his people, there also must be represented the social and voluntary agencies and the poor themselves, so that they're part of the process at the top, and then it goes right on down. Now, this challenged the politicians, and most of the trouble you read about in the papers comes from this challenge to the politicians. What's going to happen here is the poor are going to get involved, and once the poor get involved, they'll learn how to use political power, and they may use it for the establishment or the mayor, or they may use it against them. And the mayors, with any kind of a memory, remember the New Deal. And through the New Deal and through the money that came out of Washington, the Democratic Party replaced the Republican Party. That's a fact of life. The Republican establishment was, by and large, displaced by the programs of the New Deal. The New Deal gained a new constituency. It gained the minority groups and the immigrants of this country to their cause, and it brought them into the political process. They got registered, they voted out the Republicans. Now, these Democratic mayors in many of the big cities of the United States, and Republican mayors in certain places, see the same thing happening. The poor are beginning to become articulate. They're beginning to get involved. And the involvement won't only stop with the poverty program. It'll move into politics, and they'll become registered, and they'll vote their way. And so they become a challenge to the political power in the cities. So many of the cities are fighting this representation of the poor, but they don't dare openly say they're against the poor being involved. That's just not political. That's just not done. So what they do is fire back at the war on poverty for a variety of reasons. Clear example, you'll talk to a mayor, as I have as a reporter or writing a story for Harper's Magazine. They'll say the war on poverty is badly administered. And you'll say, what do you mean? So, well, I submitted a program to Washington 5 months ago, and I don't have the money for my city. So you go down to Washington, and you ask the people there and say, what's the matter with the program? Why hasn't it been funded? And Washington will say, well, the mayor doesn't want to put any poor people on the board. So you go back and you talk to the mayor and said, well, it's not bad administration. You won't give in, and they won't give you the money.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the newspaper headline is concerned, the mayor is charging bad administration, when in effect, he's fighting representation of the poor, and that's stopping the program.
Our guest tonight is Mr. William F. Haddad. He is the ex-general, inspector general of the War on Poverty, and we're, of course, talking about the politics of the poverty program. Bill, you mentioned the fact that the poor are getting a voice, but where do they get their voice from? Usually we tend to think of poor people as being somewhat illiterate or being deprived of educational advantages, that they're not fluent. Where does this leadership come from?
Well, you know what happens? First of all, they don't walk in the door. They're cynical, they're hostile, they're frustrated. The poor have been promised things for generations. Politicians go in and say, if you elect me, it could be new housing, better jobs. I can almost give you a speech of what most politicians in North Dakota or Nebraska or New York or Florida say to get elected. And, of course, once they get elected, they can't deliver on these promises. And the poor become more and more cynical. They're hostile because the programs that exist seem to be for the other person, and it's frustration built upon frustration. So, first of all, they're not going to walk in the door, and they're not going to believe anybody, including the President of the United States, when he says, this is a program for you. That's number one problem. Number two problem, many people in this country think of the poor as the Bowery bum. In this country, you can work for $1.25 an hour, 40 hours a week, and still live in poverty. Poverty is not necessarily equated with lack of intelligence. Many times, it's equated with lack of job skills, and it's equated with lack of intelligence. And they may not be that articulate. So you have those kind of problems, but you don't have the inherent problem. They're not less intelligent than other people, and that shows from all the surveys. They just haven't had the opportunity. But they can articulate their problems, and they can find their own leaders, and well, they have in certain parts of the country.
Bill, are you saying that a man who makes $1.25 an hour and 40 hours a week is still considered poor in this country or by the federal government?
Yes. The poverty line that we've established in this country, and it's a very minimum, unrealistic poverty line, is $3,000 a year. If you make less than $3,000 a year, you live in poverty. Now, what does $3,000 a year mean? Well, it means that you probably have, $1.40 a day for all expenses other than food and 23 cents a meal for food. That amounts to $3,000 a year. Out of that $1.40, you have to pay for rent, entertainment, education, other expenses, plus 23 cents a meal. Now, you know, you live pretty close to the borderline. If you live in New York City, even though poverty is ascribed to $3,000, you really live in poverty if you earn less than $5,400. Now, if you live in rural parts of the United States, $3,000 is probably, you just live on the borderline. It depends what part of the country you're from. You know, there's a lot of mistaken identification about poverty. Let me put this in here for a moment because of the audience being all over the country. Many people in this country think of poverty as a Negro problem, as an urban problem, as a minority problem. Well, the truth of the matter is that 7 out of every 10 people who are poor in this country are white. Poverty in this country is white. It's in Appalachia, it's in the rural parts of this country, and the most abject poverty does not necessarily exist in the ghettos. It exists in the rural areas of the United States where people live on $40 and $60 a week, large families. And this is the kind of cycle that we're trying to break that's self-perpetuated. Now, people who don't have money, who must work all the time just to live, don't necessarily have the chance to gain the education and the training they need. And this is what it's providing for. You know, there are 6 basic categories of poverty. The main area, the children of poverty. These are the children who are going to grow up to be poor, if most of them, if statistics hold out for the next generation as they would. You have those bypassed by industrial change, automation. You have the minority poor. You have the rural poor. You have the aged who were born poor and are dying poor. And then you have the families without fathers, the mother who's the head of a family. Those are the 6 basic categories of poverty. And in that country, it's 1 in 5 in this country now who are poor.
Our guest tonight is Mr. William F. Haddad.
He's the ex-Inspector General of the War on Poverty. And, of course, we're talking about the poverty program on Night Call. And if you'd like to express an opinion as to whether or not you think that the poverty program is a good program or are we administrating it correctly, give us a call here at Night Call. Now, our national number is area code 313-846-6601. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
All men are brothers. You've heard it before. Now, think about it. Even in a family, brothers sometimes look so different, you can't believe they're related. It's the same all over. In the brotherhood of man, there are all colors, all shapes, and all sizes. It's all in the family. Behind that face so different from yours are the mind and heart of your brother. If you have trouble remembering this, start by worshiping this week. Your faith will remind you that the color of a man's skin, his size, or his shape make as little difference as the color and size of his overcoat. Put your faith and your belief in brotherhood to work every day. Think how much better the family of man would get along if we could just remember, when you look at anybody, you're looking at a brother.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, gentle people, and welcome to Night Call. Our guest tonight is Mr. William F. Haddad. He is the ex-Inspector General of the War on Poverty and also was a founder and associate director of the Peace Corps. He's an author and a gentleman who is well-versed in the savage politics of the peace program, I should say, of the War on Poverty. Mr. Haddad is here to answer your questions or to share some views with you. And if you'd like to call Night Call, you can do so by dialing area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, you may dial us direct, and if you wish, you may make that call collect. You may reverse the charges. Now, if you get a busy signal, do not become discouraged. Just hang up and dial us again. Area code 313-846-6601. Let us know what you think about the poverty program. Is it a good deal? If you make $4,000 a year or $3,000 a year, should you be classified as in poverty? Well, these are some of the things that we're thinking about here on Night Call tonight, and we invite you to share your thinking with us. Bill, it seems to me that a lot of people have the idea that the poverty program is just a means to extend federal control over the states. What do you think about this?
Most of the money, half the money at least, goes into what we call community action, CAP. And that, the city or the community comes to us, comes to the federal government with a program. They say, this is our program. The federal government reviews it in line to some of the guidelines that we talked about. Fiscal responsibility, representation of the poor, no political control, and then they'll fund it for the city or the community, and the community will run that program, hire its own people, keep its own accounts, and in effect be a local program. It's locally generated and it's locally controlled, so it's not an extension of federal control. I happen to believe that the federal government has a responsibility in poverty. Poverty is a responsibility of everybody in this country because we all suffer from it. When there are less productive people in the society, we all suffer.
But Bill, aren't some of us afraid that if the poor begin to get a voice, now their views are not necessarily the same as the middle class American view, you see. What happens? Aren't we building a new power group? Wouldn't this group maybe threaten our value system here, at least the middle class value system, if the poor become organized? And it looks like this is what's going to happen under the new poverty program.
Well, we have a middle class that was poor only a generation or two ago. The middle class society in America is a modern thing. We came upon, we were a landed gentry at one time, we had an agrarian society, we moved into an industrial and urban society, we had immigrants come over here who lived in poverty, Italian, French, German, English, Jewish, all came over here and were assimilated and moved into the middle class. Quite a number of the people still in poverty are the parents. The children have moved out of poverty and the parents still live on the borderline of poverty. I think their values are a little bit different than the middle class, and that may be healthy for us, that our society is not static. It doesn't stay in one place. But we've got to go back to a basic principle of democracy. Everybody has a voice. Every man counts. Every person has his vote. And this is the kind of consensus government that we achieved, that we fought for, that guys are dying in Vietnam for. This is our system of government. It's no reason. You don't have a vote or a right because you have money. You have a vote and a right because you're a human being and you live in our society, in the democratic society.
Bill, we have a caller standing by in Denver, Colorado now, a lady who's listening on KTLN, Mrs. B. Jackson. Welcome to Night Call, Mrs. Jackson. Russ Gibb here, and your comment, please. Yes, ma'am.
Hello?
Yes, your comment, please.
Yes, I would like to know, being that we have the ex-inspector from the War on Poverty on the program. He is very well familiar with the Denver situation here, of that they were not funding money for the program because they did not have an active director. So we thought that it was going to be better. So they finally appointed a director 2 months ago, and somehow or other it turned out to be a politics thing that they had to put 15 members of the PER on the board, which worked out just fine. But playing politics, one party said that if the 15 members would vote his way and got him elected to the active director, he will see that they will be paid with a job. So when it came up, some of the members did not appear, but they made sure that all 15 members of the lower class was there. So they went ahead and they voted, and they voted this particular director that we have now. So
in other words, he was a man of the poor then. In other words, this...
With the understanding that he promised them all jobs.
Yeah, there's only one hitch in that. No one who serves on the board of directors of a poverty program can hold any job within the poverty program. They cannot even be partially paid by federal funds.
All right, so they resigned after the election so that they would be able to accept the job.
Have they gotten jobs?
Yes.
All 15?
Well, I know partly so far. See, it's only been 2 months now since this has taken effect. Until they got the money, why, it's just coming in.
Well, I would tend to think that the federal government, I was not in, I remember the Denver problem when I was in, and the Denver problem was somewhat like you describe it. I was not aware, I've been away for, out of the program for the last 45 days, and I was not aware when I left that anyone had promised jobs. If the facts are as you say, and I will certainly find out tomorrow and put it before somebody, then I think the Denver program would have trouble, because you cannot manipulate the program that way. You have a very active newspaper in that town that's been, the Denver Post, has been watching that program with a very critical eye from the beginning. And I would doubt if they would allow something like that to happen without bringing it to the attention of Mr. Shriver.
Now, the thing is that if outsiders that are, like you say, middle-class people and so forth, that come there for a job, they are not accepted because they're all filled up with promises ahead of time. So what is this war of poverty? Who is it for? And how do you break the ice? Now, I understand that Mr. Shriver was sent a full list of exactly what was going on some months ago. According to the paper the last couple of days, I see where it says that all the complaints that were received, he packed them up into bundles and they were turned over to the office of, well, his office there, and they stacked them away on the shelf and never even bothered to read them.
No, that cannot be true.
That sounds like a newspaper dreaming to me.
Well, that can't be true.
I can back up that fact because a letter was sent to his office in April of 1965. And there was no answer received until they went back again toward the end of last year and rehashed the whole thing out. And finally, a letter came through and said that they should go see the War on Poverty, the Denver office, and they will locate a job for him, which they did, and no job was located. And that's when they found out about the shakedown deal going on. Now, how do you break through this, or how do you clean up this to make it so it's going to be worth something? Because it's right back into the mayor's hands and this one little group, just like it was before.
Well, first of all, it has to be an independent board. It can't be under the mayor's control. That's number one.
Well, unfortunate it is, and he's also a member of the board.
Now, he can't, but it has to be an independent corporation. In Denver, there must be a separate, I forget what the name of it is in Denver, but there must be a separate corporation that's not part of the city government.
Well, Mr. Jackson, I want to thank you for asking your questions.
Can I ask him, where does the handicapped people come in on this?
Well, handicapped are covered under this act. If the handicapped have the additional liability of being poor, they are covered by the law. Now, poverty...
What department is it?
Pardon me?
What department do they go to?
Through the war and poverty. Now, the war and poverty in your city must have about, I don't know how many subdivisions. They have education, they have training, they have local centers. I think the best place to go is to the central board, and I don't know what you call it in Denver, but the central board on poverty.
The war on poverty is what they call it.
Fine, well,
they've been down there, and it's at a standstill.
Well, Ms. Jackson, seems to me the other night we went through this with you, didn't we? Didn't we go through this the other night with you? On the point that where to go for help?
Oh, Russ?
Yeah, right? Right.
Yes.
Well, I want to say that I think
the school deal is not the place.
The school deal is not the place.
No.
Well, I'm going to say that you're going to have to get onto your horse there in Denver and really stir up your newspapers to help you out, because let's see if we have some other callers in Denver who may know some answers for you. Ms. Jackson, thank you for calling Night Call.
Thanks a lot.
Good night.
What we'll do is I'll find out about that Denver situation. If there's any validity to that kind of a comment, that's precisely the type of thing that the federal government has been looking for and has prevented in many, many places.
Well, our guest, of course, is Mr. William F. Haddad, and he's a gentleman who can do something about it. Our caller was Mrs. Jackson from Denver, Colorado, a lady who had some questions about the Denver poverty setup, and also she's been trying to find out in Denver, maybe someone in Denver can help Mrs. Jackson, find out where she would go for help for the handicapped.
I think there probably is an agency as well in Denver for handicapped. You know, one of the problems about the war on poverty is that it's a beginning war. It just started. It's not going to solve all the problems in one day. It's not going to find all the jobs for the unemployed. It's not going to be able to train everybody tomorrow, and it's not going to be able to provide an education for everyone tomorrow. The point is that it makes a legitimate start, that it begins, and that you judge it not on what it does today, but the potential for what it does in the future. You don't turn back history overnight. And I think that's some when people begin to make a judgment about the war on poverty from the first step and say it's either a success or a failure or it hasn't done anything or it's closed down or it's opened up, those are not really valid comments, because it's only a startup and it's where it's going if it's headed in the right direction so it can reach its potential.
What about the Republicans through all this? Now, it seems to me that, if my memory serves me correctly, originally they opposed the war on poverty, many of them.
Yes.
Yet I understand that some of them are coming back to the new session with different ideas.
Well, first of all, you can't generalize all Republicans. There are a number of Republicans who supported it and a number who opposed it. But let's talk about those Republicans who opposed it. And there were Democrats as well who opposed it. But let's talk about the Republicans who opposed it. Many of those Republicans who opposed it have come back to this Congress like they've seen the light, like they suddenly have religion. And I just am very skeptical. They're coming back now to the Congress, these people who oppose it, and saying, we champion representation of the poor. We're for the poor. There ought to be more poor on the boards. The big city Democratic mayors are preventing them from coming on the board. They're hurting President Johnson's program. Well, for me, that's, as a reporter looking at the situation, that's blatantly political. What they're attempting to do, those who try to prevent the program from starting, are trying to exploit for political purposes the problems that arise when you try to put somebody back into the mainstream, like the poor people. They see the parade marching down the street, now they're running out in front of it. Now, this is particularly true in urban areas of the United States. In New York City, Mayor Lindsay won 40% of the Negro vote. He won 40% of the Negro vote, which is generally Democratic, for probably three reasons. One, they feel that civil rights has not come north of the Mason-Dixon line. And if you watch some of the big city problems, you can tend to agree with the Negroes. Second, because they still have ghetto conditions and the worst jobs, and they're hired last and fired first, that whole syndrome. Second, they felt that the war on poverty had not yet reached them, that expectations had been raised and they haven't been fulfilled. And third is just a general discontent with the Democratic Party in New York. Some of them felt. And they watch the same, the Republicans watch the same thing happen in Cleveland, where the discontent almost displaced a sitting mayor. They see the same discontent in Newark, in Chicago, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles. And Republicans who have not generally had the support of the minority groups in the big cities suddenly find an issue in which they can seize and run with it. Now, if they really mean it, and they really want to work for it, and they really believe it, then you welcome into the religion. I'm just very cynical as a newspaper man that these people are legitimately asking for more representation of the poor. I think they're doing it for blatant, unconscionable political reasons.
Our guest tonight is Mr. William F. Haddad. He is the ex-Inspector General of the War on Poverty, and we're talking about the savage politics of poverty in the United States. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now that's a big promise you make when you salute the flag, liberty and justice for every American. It doesn't just come true by itself. We have to work for it. Many of us are. All of us should be. We don't want to be known as a nation that breaks its word. Work at it yourself. Remember the whole Pledge of Allegiance. Remember that this nation is under God. Your faith will tell you all men are brothers. Listen to it. Worship this week and then put your faith to work. Keep your promises to every citizen of the United States.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Well, what do you think will happen if the poor people get a voice in the government of the United States with the new poverty program? Will they become a political force to be reckoned with in this country? What's this going to do with the traditional Democratic control of big cities? What's it going to do with the Republican Party? These are some of the things that we're talking about on Night Call as we deal with the savage politics of poverty. Our guest is Mr. William F. Haddad. He's a newspaper man and the ex-inspector general of the War on Poverty and also was an assistant director of the War on Poverty. If you'd like to call us here at Night Call and express your opinion, give us a buzz. It's area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, gentle people, you may call from anywhere collect. You may reverse the charges. Now when you call us, please make that call station to station. Our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. 6601. Our lines are open and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. Bill, I have a caller standing by in Denver, Colorado, a gentleman who's listening on KTLN out of Denver, Mr. Neil Bosco. Hello, Neil. Russ Gibb here. Welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please, sir.
Good evening. I approve of the general objectives, of course, the Peace Corps poverty program. I've worked around different parts of the country and I've seen some of the need for some of this program. In Appalachia, idle coal miners, and in Custer, South Dakota, the need for miners. I think that possibly a school could be set up there in Custer, South Dakota, and some transplanting arrangement might be worked out.
Neil, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you think that the average American realizes how many of his fellow citizens live in poverty?
Not at all. I don't believe they do.
Bill, what about it?
I agree with him. I think that we have sort of a blindness. In New York City, for instance, you have Central Park West, which I live on, where middle-class people live, and all the side streets have poverty, but many of the people never see the poverty, and it's the same thing in Appalachia, where it's tucked away in the hills. It's the same thing in the Southwest. We sort of have a color blindness about poverty. We just don't see it. It troubles our conscience.
I think that a marked addition to the gross national GNP would be obtainable if we consider that we take about 4 or 5 million unemployed plus another 6 million perhaps to bring up to 10 million, at least 10 million, the poverty-stricken and the unemployed. If we raise them to $5,000 a year income, this adds $500 billion to our gross national product, which is a very desirable thing. This is an obvious objective of the poverty program.
Yes, you make the people productive so they become part of society, and the way our capitalist system works, the more people that participate in the society, the greater the society grows economically. That's just part of the pattern. So there is an economic advantage in, as well as a social and moral advantage in bringing the poor back into the society.
We reduce sources of sickness and infection, and this makes for greater national health. This is all a very good thing. I worked in Fabens, Texas, 30 miles east of El Paso area. And there some of the children had no food or nothing for Christmas gifts in their home. A lot of them were migrant food workers. Some of them would go out to California part of the year and be in
Neil, can you speak up a little bit, please?
I worked, was that clear?
Yeah, we got it up to the point of you were going out to California.
Some of these migrant workers would spend part of their time in California, part in the Texas area, and it didn't make enough overall to even measure up to half the poverty standard.
One of the major areas is in the migrant workers. You know, we got a letter that the first days in the war in poverty that really sticks out of my mind. It was from a 16-year-old girl in Appalachia, and she writes, she said, you know, I only eat one time a day, and sometime I'm so hungry that I'm so glad when I go to sleep because I don't know what to do. And that's pretty much the context, the way she wrote it. And the kids that we got in the Job Corps who'd never had three meals a day, and in Appalachia they have what they call skip a meal plan. In order to have two full meals, everybody skips a meal a day. So they only eat two meals a day. And they send kids to school in many parts of this country, in the United States in 1965, in the greatest country in the free world. They send kids to school and skip years because they don't have enough shoes to send the kids to school. When you see that poverty in little children's faces, and when you know little children are hungry in this country, and you look at our great society, you really have very little patience with some of the critics of the program, because children in this country do go to bed hungry, and children in this country grow up without educational advantages. And it's just frightening that this thing could happen at this time in our lives. And it's nothing they can control. I mean, poverty is not from listfulness and laziness. Some of it may be, but most of it is just simply from lack of opportunity. And that's what this program's trying to do.
Neil, I want to thank you for calling Night Call and sharing with us your observations. Good talking to you, Neil. Good night. Mr. Neil Bosco, a gentleman from Denver, Colorado, who believes that poverty does exist in the United States. He's witnessed it himself, and a man who feels the poverty program is a good program. Neil was listening on KTLN. Let's go out to KTLN again, a gentleman listening in Denver, Colorado, Mr. George DiGrazio. Hello, George. Russ Gibb here. Welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please. George, you're going to have to really shout into that phone. I can barely hear you.
Okay. I was rather puzzled by a statement.
George, I'm not going to be able to hear you. Will you replace the call, please? Yeah, I'm sorry, George. Sometimes that happens. We'll wait for Mr. DeGrasse's call again here. Let's go out to Phoenix, Arizona now. A gentleman who's listening on KBUZ in Mesa, Arizona, Mr. Joe Chowning. Hello, Joe. Welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please. Hello? Boy, we're having trouble with these calls. I'm sorry, Joe, we can't hear that call either. I don't know what's going wrong with our equipment here. I would suggest that we check it out. Joe, can you replace that call? I'm very, very sorry. We can hardly hear you. Bill?
Yes?
I'm sorry we're having difficulty here with some of the calls, both from out west this evening. But let me ask you this. If the poor do get a voice, and they do become active, and they develop some leaders in this poverty program, what's going to happen to them when they arrive, when they are no longer poor? What type of values are they going to pick up and champion then?
Well, you know what happens in our society. It's happened before. The war on poverty is not any great revolution. It may be some social change, but it's in the tradition of this country. What happens is they achieve some kind of, first of all, they recognize that they have a right to be in power. Then they achieve some of that power, then they elect their people, then they get a slice of the pie, and then they're part of the organization, and then they pick up all the traditional values of that organization, basic values. They change some of the values, and they add to them, but basically they pick up the values of other people, become middle class, and unfortunately the pattern has been they turn around and try to keep other people out. I mean, that's a negative side of achievement. It seems to follow, it's almost a like a business cycle in this country. It just follows a pattern of existence. So I think that the poor, once they're in the society, fully are identified just as other middle-class people. There are middle-class values that go across racial lines, across ethnic lines, across religious lines. They're just certain kinds of values, certain things that you care about once you have certain kinds of achievement.
Now, it interested me, Bill, that you said that when the group arrives, whenever the group that starts out as the underdog in American society and then comes through, you know, they become the skilled trades and then eventually become the professional class, that they like to keep other groups out. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well,
after they've arrived.
They become part of the society themselves, and they feel it's almost just so much pie. And if they have to cut another person in, that means less for them. That's usually the first reaction. You get around the second and third generation, and you begin to have different reactions. But that were really underdogs in this country. There used to be a famous expression, hit him again, he's Irish. And that really meant hit him again, he's Irish. And then the Irish began to achieve. They got into the political system. They had some great political leaders in the beginning who achieved power, and most people through that political power were able to be part of the society, earned enough for their families, moved out to the suburbs, and left behind some less talented political control with the Irish. And then the Italians were coming along, and they tried to keep the Italians out, and tried to keep the Italians down. And then the Italians displaced the Irish, and the same thing happened. And the Jewish people came in, and the same thing happened. Now, that happened in most of the urban areas in the United States. Now they're being challenged by the Negroes. The Negroes are pushing people out, and right behind the Negroes in many urban areas are the Puerto Ricans, or the Spanish-speaking. But that happens to be a northeastern pattern. You find in certain parts of the country now, you find people leaving Appalachian, coming to the big cities. And that's a class that's going to come up. I believe that the poor in this country are the last unassimilated minority group. All of the poor, Appalachia to the urban cities, to the southwest, to the northwest, they are the last minority group to be assimilated. They are the last rung on the ladder that we have to pull up to get it in the window.
And then will we have a great society?
I think we'll have a good society. I think that kind of a society has its disadvantages. You know, when everybody's achieved and everybody's sort of successful and sort of content, and nobody's striving and nobody's pushing, then you get like the Greeks and the Romans, you know, where we're not there yet, but where everybody in our, and the society is seeking for the glories of life and the pleasantries of life, and no one's really out struggling and making the discoveries and fighting.
Bill, you're saying that you got to have some problems in life to learn how to live life and to make life interesting and successful.
Well, I think problems create solutions to problems. Now, I don't say that you keep people down to have it. I think we have some of that striving because you have people trying to pull their way up the ladder. I think there are other ways to achieve this kind of striving and this kind of excitement. We have it in the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps recruited kids from all over the United States who were secure, contented, had good lives ahead of them, were going up the ladder the American way and would soon be close enough to the top to suit their needs. Well, they dumped everything and went overseas for no money for 2 years in a country they never heard about, living in the backwoods, helping other people. You know, that chord exists in society. You just have to know how to play it.
Our guest tonight is Mr. William F. Haddad.
He is the ex-inspector general of the War on Poverty. He's an author, and he's been a reporter for several New York newspapers. If you'd like to join us here and express your opinion on the savage politics of poverty, give us a call at Night Call. Area code 313-846-6601. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
How often have you said, "I try to give my kids the best," and you do? Food, clothes, dolls, bikes, braces, and baseball bats, plus your love. But maybe you're forgetting the one thing that can do most to make your child's life happy. That's faith. Faith that will give his life a firm foundation, give him legs of his own to stand on. You can't just give your child faith. It comes from within him. But remember, a child follows his parents' example. Your child can learn the value of faith by seeing it work in your life. For him and for yourself, set a good example. Start by worshiping with your family this week. Then put your faith to work in your life, in your family's life. And then you'll know your kids have the very best.
This is Night Call. And here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, gentle people, and welcome to Night Call. Our guest tonight is Mr. William F. Haddad. He is the recently resigned inspector of the War on Poverty. He also was a founder and associate director of the Peace Corps. And along with being assistant to both Robert F. Kennedy and the late Senator Kefauver. If you'd like to join us and share your views with us on poverty on Night Call, give us a buzz at area code 313-846-6601.
Bill, I have a caller in Denver, the gentleman that we had a little bit of difficulty with a few moments ago on the line. We'll try it again. Mr. George DeGrazio. And Mr. DeGrazio is listening on KTLN. Hello, George. Welcome to Night Call.
Good evening, sir.
That's much better. Your comment, please.
Yes. I wanted to ask Mr. Haddad a couple of quick questions. First of all, I was rather puzzled by a statement he made concerning poverty, and I checked a textbook of mine. I'm a student at Colorado University.
Right.
And the textbook stated that the per capita income for the United States was $2,200. And I thought this rather paradoxical, as Mr. Haddad's figure for poverty was around 3,000 or in that number. And I was hoping you would be willing to elaborate.
Yeah, well, actually the 3,000 figure is low. Many other people put it much higher than 3,000. Actually, per capita must be every man, woman, and child in this country. That's where it might come from. Well, I think you take the total income of the United States and divide it by the total population, and you probably get the per capita. So I think the difference in there is, for instance, the 3,000 is a combined earning. So that would, by your figures, it would be 4,400. See, in other words, you take the man and wife for 3,000, and it would come 4,400 under your figures.
Yes, I believe per capita is gross national product.
Yeah, divided by people.
Population, yes.
Yeah.
Another statement I'd like to briefly make is that I'm sure that you know quite a bit more about the poverty program than I am, but I would propose to you that generalizations about poverty should be, I think you should watch it, because I'm not trying to be...
Go ahead, back to your comment.
There goes the telephone fading again, George. You're fading out on us. You're sounding like you're off in Mars somewhere.
Yeah, well, I think the connection's better.
Are you back now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, right.
Okay, fine. For instance, I came in contact with a boy who was related to the poverty program. I mean, he was under its benefits last summer. And it was very odd. He earned his summer's wages, and I asked him what he was going to do with it because I was rather curious, and he said he was very happy. A grin lit up all over his face, and he stated that now he'd be able to buy a new car. And I was just rather odd, and although I feel that poverty is an environmental circumstance, certainly, and that environment shapes what we're going to...
George?
Yes.
Did you ever read The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard?
By Vance Packard? I read about half of it.
Yeah, well, you finish it up, and you'll answer your own question why that kid bought that car.
Well, I can't. That's another generalization, I feel, because there you're assigning it all to advertising. And I don't know. I think that the point I'm trying to bring out is that I think it should be sort of a balance between federal and local, that is, people who are concerned closely with the poverty. I mean, you can't say, well, let's turn it all over to the people who are, you know, involved in it. And you can't also say, well, let's give it all to the federal government. Now, I don't know whether Mr. Haddad has clarified this or not.
It's a partnership. There are people with technical knowledge of dealing with poverty, people in social welfare agencies, and they're the people who are poor who know the problems, and they're the politicians who bear the responsibility as the elected officials of a city. And it's a partnership between these people. Before, the poor have not been part of that partnership. It's been one of the weaknesses that they've been excluded. They've been served. We've had a very patronizing attitude towards poverty. Now, the people in poverty, their values, and the things that they're influenced by are very little different than anybody else in our society. They may be less sophisticated in the type of appeals that reach it because of lack of experience and money and exposure. But basically, the poor people react like anybody else emotionally and advertising-wise and stuff like that. And I agree with you 100% about the generalizations of poverty. Poverty is a big problem, a lot of people in it, and there's no common cause and there's no common cure, but there are certain generalizations that you can make, and one of the generalizations that you can make is that many of the people in poverty are not there because of their own fault. It's fault they've inherited by environment and prior conditions.
George, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you, also.
Good talking to you. Good night. Mr. George DeGrazio, a gentleman from Denver, Colorado, a student, who feels that we better watch ourselves when we generalize on poverty. And, of course, George was listening on KTLN. Let's go out to Scotts Bluff, Nebraska now, a gentleman who's listening on KNEB in Scotts Bluff, Mr. Larry Nelson. Hello, Larry. Larry, Russ Gibb here. Welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please. Yeah, hello. We just lost him, too. This is not our night with telephones. Let's go out to Indianapolis, Indiana now. A gentleman who's listening on WFBM, Mr. Jerry Rout, or is that Prout? Hello, Jerry. Welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please.
Yes, I'd like to make a couple comments.
Yes, sir.
First of all, on this poverty program, what I've seen here in Indianapolis and read in the papers, the money issued for the program, the people in charge running it, is getting better than 50% of all the money. And the people who need it are getting a lot lesser amount than what they could be getting.
In other words, the administrative costs of running the program are 50%. That's unusually high.
Well, on what an article in the paper here a couple months back gave the amount and the amount that it cost to run it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was running better than 50%.
Yeah, I think, I'm not questioning your figure, I think that's, you know, by the national standard, that's quite high. You have one particular problem here, and that's when you start out something, you start out with the structure, and you don't reach the people. And then as you reach the people, the overhead goes down. And so I don't think any program would continue to be funded by the federal government where 50% of the money was eaten up administrative costs and salaries. Maybe at the startup period, but it better rapidly get down from there, or the federal government, I think, would come in and curtail that program severely.
Well, another comment that I'd like to make, this program, to me, and the way I look at it, it goes back to the old, back when the colonies was formed. I forget the name of it, but they tried a true form of communism. And this didn't prove out because one man would do the work and the other one sat back and ride. Now, this program, to me, the middle class is carrying most of the tax bill because the higher class people and the business people have many ways to get around the taxation. And the middle class is making $5,000, $6,000. Well, after the taxes are pulled and everything that, he's making not more than, or not much more than the $3,000 or $4,000 which is issued to the, or which makes you qualify.
No, I think the tax loopholes of the rich are quite well known, but I don't think this is a form of communism at all. I think that what happens here is we're trying to bring people into the society. It's just like many people take advantage of Social Security. People are going to now take advantage of Medicare. People have taken advantage in the WPA days in the farm areas. A lot of people are really being run out because of the depression in this country, which they could not control. And the federal government came in and helped save the farm. This is what we're helping to do here, is make people productive so you won't have this tax burden. In this society, we're not going to let families not have any income. And you're going to have to give them money on welfare and relief. What this proposes to do is to make these people productive so that with this expenditure of money, intelligently and wisely spent and administered, it leads to a person getting a job, supporting himself and his family, and then his children going on and getting an education and taking themselves out of poverty. So in the long run, if you want to use that barometer or standard, it reduces the taxation on the middle class. I think it's hard sometimes to appreciate that, particularly when you're working your head off to make $5,000, $6,000, the government takes some of it away, and you see other people using that money. But I think in the long run, it's a very profitable democratic program. The communists don't do anything like this. The communists have a completely different philosophy. They take away your rights. Nobody can, you know, that whole business that doesn't go along with this.
Jerry, I want to thank you for calling Night Call and sharing with us your comments.
Okay.
Good talking to you, sir. Good night. Gentleman from Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on WFBM. Now we'll try Scotts Bluff, Nebraska again. We'll try the gentleman who we had disconnected here. Gentleman who's listening on KNEB out of Scotts Bluff, Mr. Larry Nelson. Hello, Larry. Larry, you have about 2 minutes. Larry, welcome to Night Call.
Well, thank you. thank you. It's a privilege to be here. I just tuned into the program, and some of your listeners might be a little bit irritated with some of my questions because they might be duplications, but I was just wondering, what was the definition of the government's poverty program? I mean, who qualifies and who doesn't?
Well, it was an economic standard. Those who are earning less than $3,000 a year, families earning less than $3,000 a year.
Who is responsible for the disbursements of these poverty checks, if they are checks?
No, they're not checks. No one gets a direct payment like a welfare or relief thing. The programs are educational and training. And people who earn less than $3,000 a year qualify for an educational program or a training program. Nobody gets cash money put in their hands.
What are some of these programs, Bill?
Well, for instance, there are a number of illiterate people in this country. This helps these people to learn to read and write. There are a lot of jobs which require skills. This provides a training for those skills. There are a number of unfilled jobs in this country. If you had the skills, this is to give the people the skills for those particular jobs. There was a magnificent program this summer called Head Start, where they put children, preschool children got a summer's preschool education, they got a medical exam, a dental exam, nutritional help, a nationwide program that went into 13,000 centers around the country. That kind of thing is being done with the money.
Larry, we don't have any more time on Night Call. I want to thank you for calling. Good night, sir.
Good night, Al.
Mr. Larry Nelson, a gentleman from Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, who's listening on KNEB. And Bill, I want to thank you for being our guest on Night Call, and I want to wish you a lot of luck on your new book. Is it going to be on the poverty program?
Oh, I think this book is going to be on the Congress, and it's going to be probably as controversial as the poverty program.
Our guest tonight was Mr. William F. Haddad. He's the ex-inspector general of the War on Poverty. Wednesday night on Night Call, our guest will be Dr. Robert Houston, and we'll be talking about why we are losing faith in the Christian church. And if you have some comments, or if you'd like to find out why Mr. Houston thinks that we may be losing some faith in the Christian church, you'll be able to talk to him directly and express your views. What do you think about the Christian church? Until then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station. As a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life, Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.